The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week, we're looking at what science has to say about the psychological and biological underpinnings of belief. We're joined by science writer Jesse Baring to discuss his book, The Belief Instinct, The Psychology of Souls, Destiny, and the Meaning of Life. But before that, we'll find out what neuroimaging can and can't tell us about how faith affects the brain. I'm talking to Dr. Andrew Newberg, Director of Research of the Myrna Brin Center of Integrative Medicine at Thomas Jefferson University. He's also the author of How God Changes Your Brain and Why God Won't Go Away. Welcome to the show, Andrew.
Thank you for having me on your program.
Now, there have been a number of studies about the intersection of neurology and belief in God, some of them conducted by you. So is this a field formally?
It's an emerging field, I think. There has been a much larger number of studies that have begun to come out that have been looking at a whole different array of different aspects of spirituality, religiousness, specific practices like meditation and prayer. That's probably has been the early target, which is the study of practices like meditation and the impact that those practices have on the brain, which I think most people can understand why they would have an impact. But then the studies that I've been involved in, and there's several others, which have begun to try to get at not just the practices, but the experiences that people have, and ultimately how they convert those experiences into some type of belief about the universe, about God, about ultimate reality, whatever it is that their particular belief system looks at.
So maybe tell us about some of the newest research around our brains and God. Maybe some of the more interesting studies that you're aware of.
Well, actually, there was a very recent study that came out in the last year or so that actually looked at people who had brain damage and actually looked at brain damage in a part of the brain called the parietal lobe, which is located in the back part of the brain. This is an area that I've been very interested in as well in my own research because it normally is an area that takes out the sensory information that comes into us and helps us to construct a sense of ourself and to orient that self with regard to the world. One of the most common experiences that people have in a religious or spiritual context is the loss of that sense of self, the sense of connectedness, the sense of oneness with God or ultimate reality, again, whatever the person's belief system is. And what this study showed was that people who had brain damage, particularly in the right parietal lobe, actually were expressing greater experiences of oneness, greater experiences of connectedness. And the authors of that particular study suggested, again, that it was this area of the brain that, because it was damaged, somehow was enabling that individual to have this kind of an experience. Myself and colleagues, as we've done brain scan studies of people in prayer and meditation, we have also found alterations going on in this particular part of the brain, again, which seem to be associated with that very important element of these kinds of religious and spiritual experiences. So that's certainly one very interesting area that I think needs to be explored more, which is the pathological element. You know, how, whether it's brain damage or patients who have temporal lobe seizures, seizures in a part of the brain that have also been linked to being hyper-religious, being excessively religious. And of course, I mean, everyone always talks about the schizophrenic patient who believes that they're Jesus Christ or something like that, and the different hallucinations that they have. But all of this to me is pieces of a puzzle that tells us more and more about how our brain is associated with these kinds of experiences.
So how does belief look in the brain of a healthy person?
Well, I don't know if there's been a specific way to be able to tell what's going on in a particular belief, but when people have, in fact, actually, one interesting study that was done also, I guess, about a year or two ago was done by Sam Harris, who also has a neuroscience background. And essentially what he did was he was looking at the areas of the brain that were activated when people believed, when they were focusing on their belief in God versus when they were focusing on their belief in just, you know, everyday objects, that, you know, the world was the way it was. And essentially found that there was no difference, that the brain seems to respond to a belief in God in a very similar way as it responds to beliefs in other things. And typically we're talking about the areas of our brain that are involved in our memory, that are involved in our ability to construct abstract ideas and concepts. And this is in part a little bit related to the areas that I just mentioned about the parietal lobe and also the temporal lobe, which is located along the side of the brain, that that are part of helping us to create our abstract ideas about everything, about morality, about politics, and of course about religion and spirituality. So, and in fact, there's other research, which has also been done fairly recently, which I think corroborates that notion that when somebody believes in religion, in God, they tend to treat that belief the same way they treat the rest of reality. And in fact, one study showed, a brain scan study showed, that when people who were very religious engaged in prayer that was conversational prayer, where they were kind of talking to God, it activated the same areas of the brain when they were just talking to another person. Essentially, their brain is treating God as another person, just as they would, you know, in their everyday life. So we're getting a sense at where these different things are occurring in the brain in terms of the areas, but also how similar those changes are, irrespective of the specifics of the beliefs. Now, of course, our brain scans also have certain limitations, and I can't tell you that when somebody believes in God versus when they believe in, you know, America, that it's the same nerve cells. We don't have the ability to get down to that level of detail. And that's, of course, what also makes this whole field of research challenging. We can say that it's in this area of the brain, but we don't know for sure how similar or how different all of these different kinds of beliefs and experiences actually are.
Well, let's talk a bit about your research specifically.
Well, a lot of my research it started out looking at practices like meditation and prayer, where we would typically bring in expert meditators into our lab, and we would do brain scans of them to look at general activity levels in the brain. We would typically have them do their particular practice of meditation or prayer, and we used several different kinds of scans. One of the first ones we used was something called SPECT imaging that looks at blood flow changes in the brain. Functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, is another way of getting at blood flow. And the reason that blood flow is so important is that that's what the brain basically uses for its energy. So the more active a particular area is, the more blood flow it gets. And that way we can see which areas are turned on or turned off, involved in a particular process. So when we have studied, for example, meditation and prayer, what we typically find are areas of increased activity in another part of the brain called the frontal lobe, located right behind the forehead. This is an area that is always active whenever we focus our attention on anything. So focusing our attention on a prayer or a particular phrase or what have you would make sense to activate that part of the brain. We've also found decreases of activity in the parietal lobe when these people are experiencing a loss of their sense of self, a loss of their sense of space and time, a sense of oneness and connectedness, which we think is associated with changes of activity in that area of the brain. And in fact, what a lot of our research has shown that there are many different parts of the brain that get involved, and that, I think, to me makes so much sense because these practices involve our cognitive processes, our emotional processes, our experiences, and therefore, depending on the exact type of practice and the kinds of experiences the person has, we see lots of different changes going on in the brain. And some of our more recent research is showing the more permanent effects of doing those practices, that if you started today doing a meditation practice, you will create baseline changes in your brain's function that exist over time. And there's other investigators who have also found this with different kinds of practices. So it does suggest that as a person continues to believe in their religious tradition or in a non-religious tradition, whatever it is that their belief system is, the stronger those beliefs become and the stronger the connections in the brain become that support those beliefs.
You're tuned in to Skeptically Speaking. My guest today is Dr. Andrew Newberg, Director of Research of the Nirma Brin Center of Integrative Medicine at Thomas Jefferson University, and the author of How God Changes Your Brain. Now, how controversial is this research, not just yours, but this entire area of study? And I should say not necessarily among religious people, but among scientists.
I think on one hand, people from all different backgrounds and belief systems are interested. I think in general, there has been a great deal of interest in the medical community as As a physician myself, when I take care of people, there are so many people who have religious and spiritual beliefs and turn to them in times of crisis and so forth. And I think as someone who is engaged in the healing process, it becomes important for us to understand at least something about what that relationship is. So a lot of physicians, a lot of healthcare providers, nurses, and so forth, have come to realize that we need to learn more about this and try to understand it better. As you mentioned, I mean, obviously some people who are on the very religious end of the spectrum, they're concerned about what ours or other people's research may say, especially if it may ultimately point to a biological basis of these experiences and these beliefs. Does that write off religion? Does that say that religion is something that's just a manifestation of the brain or associated with some kind of pathological condition, and they're nervous about whether we might ultimately wind up in that kind of a conclusion?
Right.
On the other hand, I think sometimes those people who are atheists, who want to have a very material perspective of how the world works, when at least myself, when I look at these brain scans, what it tells me is what's going on in the brain when they have the religious and spiritual experience or the belief. It doesn't tell me whether it's true or not. So I usually leave that possibility open, and I know that that has created some concern in the non-believing population. But I think most of the people and most of the studies have been, you know, we're getting better at doing the studies. We're getting better at understanding the implications, and I think in general, people, at least my experience has been that people have been very open to it and very eager to see where this leads and what kind of information we may obtain from it.
One of the criticisms that I was reading was that that your study of meditation doesn't necessarily extrapolate to broader religious phenomena.
And that's absolutely, you know, I would totally agree with that. And in fact, that was one of the things that I had always said at the beginning. As a researcher, you have certain limitations in terms of what you can do and what you can look at. And we decided, based on what our available technologies were and how we could do it, that we would start by studying a practice like meditation. But as you mentioned, and I completely agree, that that isn't what religion is, per se, and it's not necessarily something you can extrapolate to all different kinds of practices, all different kinds of beliefs, different traditions. That to me is where the exciting part of this field is, which is that there's so much left for us to actually look at and try to understand. And I think that we can begin to get at many other aspects of these questions about how people actually believe in God or don't believe in God, and why they do, and how that may relate to not just brain activity itself, but to different neurotransmitters, different chemicals in the brain. So we're working on designing these studies to try to get at a much more detailed picture. But yes, certainly we always have to be cautious about, you know, just because somebody meditates and then their frontal lobe turns on, that we say, you know, that's the religion spot of the brain or something like that. And most of the research, in fact, if anything, tells me that there are many different parts of the brain that get involved, and that this is an extremely complex phenomena and is not going to have a very simple answer in terms of how it relates to biology.
So what are you studying next, sir?
Well, some of the things that we're looking at next is actually to look more specifically the neurotransmitters. I'm very interested in trying to not just look at blood flow, not just look at basic brain activity, but how neurotransmitters like dopamine, serotonin play out. In fact, another controversial study that came out several years ago was done by a Dr. Dean Hamer, who is a behavioral geneticist at NIH, and he looked at the relationship between a gene that helped with dopamine and serotonin levels in the brain as being related to certain kinds of experiences that people often relate to spirituality. Feelings of self-transcendence was what it was called. So we're interested in looking at that in the brain now, not just looking at what's going on in the genes. And I've also been very intrigued by trying to understand the longitudinal effects of all of this. If we start a practice today, how does that change our brain a month from now, a year from now, 10 years from now? And also trying to understand just how human beings develop their religious and spiritual ideas over time. And I think the other piece, which is also, you know, I'm sure a lot of people in your audience will be very interested in, is the whole negative side of religion and spirituality. And that's something that really hasn't been studied very much from a scientific perspective. But can we really start to understand the difference in a person's brain who's religious and is immensely compassionate and loving and open towards all other people, and someone who is very religious and is very closed off very, you know, hates people who don't believe the way they do, willing to strap the bomb around their chest to blow up people who believe in something else. What's going on? What's the difference? And there's got to be something physiologically going on as well as just purely on the basis of doctrine. So I personally would like to see a little bit more about how we can understand the various negative aspects of religion as well, with the goal ultimately of trying to convert those kind of negative approaches to religion into something that's more positive.
And how exactly would you study that?
Well, I mean, obviously one way to do this is to advance the brain scanning techniques. It'd be very interesting to look at people's attitudes about different religious traditions. I mean, we don't necessarily have to go out and find terrorists, but if we just look at the general population, there are some people who are more open about beliefs and some people who are more closed about beliefs. We could scan them and we could see where the differences are in the brain. Is this something related to dopamine? Is it something related to a certain area of the brain that makes us more willing to be open or closed to other ideas? We could look at those individuals who have different emotional standpoints on religion, and there was a study that came out of Baylor that looked at different religious attitudes, and some people look at, people who are religious, some people look at God in a very positive emotional way, that God is benevolent and helping them. Other people look at God in a very negative way, that God is punishing them. So again, we could look at groups of people who feel both ways and try to understand the differences in the brain's emotional systems and a part of the brain called the limbic system, and how that may be affected by these different beliefs and how they may be related. So there are a lot of interesting ways of trying to get at that. Again, we can go back to looking at different pathological conditions and see how that may be related to religion and spirituality. So there's just a tremendous opportunity, I think, to be able to explore these kinds of questions in much more detail than we've ever had before. We're really just scratching the surface in many ways. And to me, again, this is why your first question, is it a field? Well, it's an emerging field because there's so much that we could do. And it's a matter of just getting the number of people together who could really begin to engage these questions, do the research, and provide this information to the general public.
Fascinating work, sir. I very much look forward to following it. You can find links to Dr. Andrew Newberg, author of How God Changes Your Brain and Why God Won't Go Away, on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back with Jesse Baring, author of The Belief Instinct, after these messages.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long-distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and my guest today is Jesse Baring. Jesse is the former director of the Institute of Cognition and Culture at Queen's University Belfast, and he's a frequent contributor to Scientific American, Slate, and Das Magazine in Switzerland. He's also the author of The Belief Instinct. Welcome to the show, Jesse.
Hi, Desiree. Thanks for having me.
Now, people who don't believe in God usually point to our very human need for comfort as the reason that some people do believe. But you say that explanation doesn't go quite deep enough, correct?
I think the sort of the need-based theories, the sort of existential reliever or comfort, have some currency. I think that it does help to explain the motivation for it sticking with the belief itself. But yes, my model is a little bit different. It's sort of an alternative theory about what drives the sort of intuition to be religious itself. It's not so much that we believe because we simply want to believe that it's true. My position and the belief instinct is that we believe because that's the natural psychological stance.
So
it's difficult not to believe.
And that's the thing. So your theory is somewhat based on the idea that we are deeply interested in other people's intentions. And you're actually not the first one to argue this. Daniel Dennett spoke of the intentional stance. So maybe tell us about that.
Right. So I first became interested in these questions because I was working with chimpanzees back as a graduate student. And the big question at the time, this was in the mid-90s or so, and it still is actually a lingering question that is unresolved, is the extent to which chimpanzees have what's called a theory of mind, like human beings do. Are they meaningfully different from human beings in lacking this fundamental capacity to think about the mental states of other chimpanzees, of people or animals, and so on? So I guess maybe we should first clarify what this big term theory of mind is, because right. my whole model sort of hinges on this construct of a theory of mind. And like you said, Dan Dennett articulated sort of an earlier version of this called the intentional stance. And there are lots of caveats and sort of nuances to the general construct itself. But the big, let's just call it theory of mind for the sake of simplicity. And the big idea is that human beings are unique in the sense that we can reason about the unobservable psychological states of others. And it's called a theory of mind because the mind itself and mental states are theoretical constructs, like other invisible causal forces, just like gravity, for instance. We can't see gravity. We could have a theory of gravity, and that's probably fairly accurate. The same thing is true when we're reasoning about the theoretical constructs that motivate behavior. So if we were we're in different rooms right now, you're in the studio and I'm in my home in Ithaca, but if I were in front of you, I would just see your body. I would see you moving around in different ways. So physically, I just see, you know, your head's moving, your eyes are going in different directions. I see a body moving around. But because I have a theory of mind, I can empathize with what you're experiencing or why you're doing what you're doing. I can have a theoretical understanding of why you're behaving the way that you do. And that's basically what a theory of mind is, the theory of unobservable psychological states. So it all starts with that, basically. And when you have this theory of mind, the evolution of this theory of mind capacity was very useful. From an evolutionary perspective, it would be biologically adaptive in the sense that it helped us to explain and predict the behaviors of others. We could get into people's minds more effectively and understand what they were about to do to us or how they were going to respond to us, and we could predict their future actions and so on. And that helped us to make good decisions regarding our social behaviors around them. And it was so useful that it seems to have spread into areas of the natural world where it doesn't properly belong. So not only did we evolve a theory of mind to reason about the mental states of other people and animals and so on that actually have minds, but it spilled over into all these ontological categories in the natural world where there were no minds. So that's the sort of thrust of the argument, that God is a psychological byproduct of normal human social cognition.
Well, and you mentioned that the theory of mind, that psychological capacity, might be the thing that makes us uniquely human, because I thought that was tools.
You know, this is an age-old question. What is it about human beings that makes us special or unique? And I think that it's very easy to look at that question and to sort of detect some sort of species-centric bias. And the implication is that somehow we're saying that human beings are special or better than other species.
Right.
That's not the argument. The argument is simply that there genuinely might be meaningful cognitive differences between human beings and our closest living relatives, in this case chimpanzees, that had evolved over a period of hundreds of thousands of years, millions of years, since we last shared a common ancestor. A lot happened during that period of time. You know, there were 20 intermediate species of hominids separating the common ancestor of human beings and chimpanzees. So one thing that may be different about us, not better, it doesn't make us, it's not a value judgment against chimpanzees. It's just a fact, just the fact that, you know, we walk upright and have, differently shaped morphologically. Our pelvic girdles are designed for walking upright and bipedally. It's just a fact. And the argument here, similarly, is that through the process of brain evolution, we have new cognitive mechanisms that are relatively distinct from other species. And it could be theory of mind that's the big defining factor.
And so the theory of mind is the reason that we tend to anthropomorphize animals then, and objects occasionally.
That's why it's so difficult for us to look at other species' behaviors, dogs, for instance, especially animals that we're very familiar with, and not see their behavior as being motivated by the same motivations that would cause us to do that. So we have this sort of lens of a theory of mind that we project our own psychological states onto them. And this is not to say that they don't have minds. It's just to say that we reason about their actions oftentimes as though they were other human beings.
You put it really well in your book that the concept is easiest to understand if you think about how you react to someone else's unexpected behavior, right?
Right. So there are triggers that sort of launch us into a theory of mind mode of reasoning. So the best case example is when somebody does something that's completely unexpected. It doesn't make sense. So if I were to, all of a sudden start screaming in the middle of this interview, say something extraordinarily offensive or insane, this would be surprising in principle. This would be unexpected, and you would basically be trying to figure out why in the hell I'm actually doing that. Am I doing this to be? I think that it's funny. Am I doing this because I really am insane? Am I doing it because I'm nervous? You know, all these types of things would be you trying to get into my head about why I'm doing something that's so unexpected.
Right.
In the normal human social domain, theory of mind becomes most apparent when people do things that are unexpected. We're trying to, we're theorizing literally about why they're doing what they're doing. So when people do what's expected, we don't really try to sort of psychoanalyze their motivations. We really do it when things don't make sense. And the same thing happens, I think, and this is what I've argued in the book, when things don't go as expected in our sort of existential lives. When all of a sudden our plans are thwarted by being diagnosed with a fatal illness, for instance, or even something as simple as, missing a flight because you left your passport at home or something like that. Things are going wrong. Things are violating your expectations. And as a consequence, we're trying to find out, we oftentimes, many people at least, try to figure out why this is happening to me.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and my guest today is Jesse Baring, former director of the Institute of Cognition and Culture at Queen's University Belfast, and author of The Belief Instinct. So here is where God comes in. You say that the feeling that there is something grander out there is due to our overactive theory of mind.
Right. So in the absence of a theory of mind, just think about, it's fairly simplistic, but it's true that we couldn't even conceptualize anything like God. God basically is a bundle of mental states, a bundle of psychological states. The Bible is sort of a psychoanalytic interpretation of why God does what he does. It's all about getting inside of God's head. And in the absence of this basic theory of mind capacity, we couldn't even entertain questions about why bad things happen to good people, for instance, whether or not there are sort of messages embedded in natural events that God is trying to share with us and trying to figure out what he's trying to tell us. I mean, all of this is just basic social cognition if it's transferred at the level of human social behavior. But it's on a sort of grander scale when we're thinking about the religious domain.
Well, let's break this down. One of the reasons that people give for believing in a higher power is the need to have a sense of purpose. So how is that related to the theory of mind?
If you think about this construct of purpose, and I think this is something that a lot of atheistic sort of evolutionary biologists have struggled with, or at least struggled to sort of articulate clearly, by saying, because, we still get this, even if you are completely atheistic and you don't believe in God, which I am, incidentally, if it's not clear enough, but if you don't believe that, you still oftentimes have this sort of recrudescing psychological, this sort of nagging psychological question about, well, what's it all for? why am I here? What's the purpose of life? I mean, even if you reject that sort of question as silly, it doesn't mean that it's not there and it doesn't sort of jab at you occasionally. Yeah. So the argument is that these questions of purpose are sort of our interest in finding out why we are here, why we're here as individuals, and why human beings are here more generally, is an artifact of something that even 5 and 7 year olds have, which is called teleological reasoning or teleofunctional reasoning. And that sounds like a big scary word, but it's not a really difficult idea, actually. It just simply means teleofunctional reasoning is the idea that there was a designer that had a preconceived function or purpose in mind before creating something. And to look at that entity or that object, whatever it is, and try to figure out what it's for, we're basically trying to get inside the mind of that creator. So one example would be in the non-religious domain, just in the everyday applied domain, if you were in a museum and you saw some really sort of obscure gadget in the medical wing, and it looked like it could be used for anything, but it's frustrating not to know what something is for when you see an artifact, some sort of strange arcane artifact that it's not entirely clear what it was for. When we're trying to figure that out, we're basically trying to get inside the mind of the creator who designed it originally. So the idea here is that this idea of purpose, or this sort of niggling sense that there's always got to be a purpose or a function to something, spills over into our reasoning about the purpose of life too. Even though existentially there is no real purpose, it's still the question that we ask.
That's interesting, because these kind of feelings are usually chalked up to cultural conditioning. So why isn't that a good enough explanation on its own?
Well, you've got to have the right cognitive substrate for culture to work on, to sort of flesh out all the interesting sort of exotic cross-cultural theological ideas. But you've got to have the mold to work with to get that expressed to begin with. So, you know, if we think back to, our earlier discussion about chimpanzees, you can enculturate chimpanzees in a human home as much as you want, give them the same type of developmental experience as a human child, but they won't be plagued with these types of questions that we are plagued with. It's difficult to really know that unless we somehow can see inside their thoughts, because they can't communicate. But you've got to have the theory of mind to begin with. And we do know that theory of mind from most of the primate research suggests that there's a big gap in at least the sophistication of our mental state reasoning versus that of other species.
Well, and there have been a number of studies done in this area with children.
Yeah, so Deb Kellerman, who's a psychologist at Boston University, has done most of this research on teleological reasoning in very young children. She looks at 7 to 9 year olds mostly, which her work suggests that that children have a very difficult time not thinking in teleofunctional terms. If you're reasoning about an artifact, what's a fork for instance, teleofunctional reasoning makes sense because there really was an original designer in mind that had this idea in mind. But if we're thinking about a lion, what's a lion for? The lion isn't for anything in particular. The lion exists because it exists. But children prefer answers like, well, a lion is here to go into the zoo. Or the lion is there to watch over her cubs. There's some teleofunctional significance to the existence of whole organisms, not just to artifacts.
The studies that have been done on individuals without a basic science education, and also on people with Alzheimer's,
yes,
they show a similar pattern to children, do they not?
Right. So we can cure our teleological bias or our teleofunctional reasoning by scientific information or scientific knowledge, and it can sort of eradicate this teleological reasoning where it doesn't belong. But for children who, people who never have an advanced scientific education, such as there have been several studies with Romanian Romani adults that have absolutely no scientific education whatsoever. They're reasoning like a preschool aged child in terms of their teleological beliefs. And it also, like you said, it comes back after the scientific the semantic information is somehow eroded through Alzheimer's disease, and you find the teleofunctional bias coming back to the surface. So it never really goes away. It's just suppressed by scientific information.
We have a couple of questions piling up here. This one's from the chat, from Bearing Fangirl.
Isn't our why me tendency just a lack of personal responsibility?
No. I mean, I think ideally that we like to think that we have some control over our ability to keep ourselves from asking questions like why me. But I mean, to give you an example, I remember quite clearly, I talk quite a bit about my mother in the book, and a lot of my experiments were actually motivated by her experiences, because she was diagnosed with ovarian cancer at a fairly early age, and you know, really went through a difficult series, years of chemotherapy treatment. And she was, you know, she was a fairly strong agnostic, if not atheist, and she never had that sort of why me disposition ever. And she would say that it's absolutely ridiculous to think in those terms. But I also remember several very clear incidents where she was in excruciating pain, and you saw those types of questions flaring up. I remember her saying very clearly, you know, why is this happening to me? What have I done to deserve this? And it was at the peak of her pain. She had no control over what was happening to her. And, you know, when she felt better, I would say, you know, that's kind of weird that you would say something like that. You don't really believe that, do you? And she would deny ever expressing it.
Interesting.
That she ever actually said it. So I think that everybody has the tendency, even if it's not expressed consciously, to think of themselves as being the target of some moralistic force. So, yes, we can reject it, and again, I don't think my mother believed that she was being punished by God or anything like that for something that she's done wrong, but it was lurking right beneath the surface.
We have a question from Twitter, from Bakke.
Do we use this mode of reasoning and project it onto the world as a whole as though it's a unified being? Does that equal a God figure?
I think that the starting point, or the default stance from a developmental perspective, when we're looking at children's reasoning, for instance, about these types of questions, is that there is just some big bland mind, basically, that we're trying to figure out how the world came into being and what specific things are for and so on. But it's not... But it becomes systematically refined as a consequence of being exposed through religious indoctrination to have particular personalities and characteristics of the supernatural figures that we're exposed to culturally. But beyond all that, yeah, I suppose, you know, there is a universal mind, no matter what we want to call it. And there's certainly lots of exotic variations around the world, and multiple gods in some societies. But there, in every society, there is at least one high god or one supernatural agent that is concerned about what we do in our social lives.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we'll be right back after the break to talk more about the belief instinct with author Jesse Bearing.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're digging into a fascinating and little-known chapter in the life of one of the giants of modern science. Guest host Marie-Claire Shanahan spends the hour with Tom Levinson, professor of science writing at MIT, to talk about his book, Newton and the Counterfeiter, The Unknown Detective Career of the World's Greatest Scientist. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and today we're talking about the potential psychological underpinnings of religious belief. Joining me is Jesse Bearing, former director of the Institute of Cognition and Culture at Queen's University Belfast, and he's the author of The Belief Instinct. Now, we have a number of questions. This one is going in the exact direction I wanted to go. This is from the chat from Bytor.
Are belief in the supernatural and pareidolia related in any way?
I'm not familiar with that term. Actually, sounds like something that I should be familiar with.
Think of the images of Jesus that people see on toast.
Oh, pattern recognition.
There you go.
Okay, that's a slightly different construct. So, yeah. So there's a. I mean, I don't talk about that too much in my work, but there are some really good theories about this sort of hyperactive agency detection device, which was originally formulated by an anthropologist called Stuart Guthrie. He wrote a classic book called Faces in the Clouds, which really sort of laid out this position that religion is the consequence of a hypervigilance to prospective predators or threats or outgroup members that could pose some sort of threat or problem for us. So we were sort of constantly on the lookout and hypervigilant to either faces or rustling branches, things, out walking in the forest or something like that. And somehow that basically transferred itself into the representation of ghosts and spirits and dead ancestors and ultimately God. So I think it's a part of it. I think that what that model, this sort of hyperactive agency detection device model, misses or glosses over, at least, is the social cognitive dimension. Again, theory of mind. It is a type of theory of mind, but when we're, we don't typically, our religious types of intuitions don't typically emerge when we, hear a branch falling in the woods or something like that. Maybe it's spooky, but when we really engage in these types of why me types of questions, for example, there's no real physical stimulus in the environment that triggers that type of reasoning. It's much more abstract. It's a life event, for instance. So you fail your course, or you break up with your boyfriend or girlfriend, or you're going through a divorce, or your child is ill. There's no concrete physical trigger that launches us into trying to explain those types of events. They're much more sort of abstract autobiographical experiences that motivate us to get inside the mind of God or gods or whatever.
But you do say that without a theory of mind, we wouldn't be able to see those signs at all.
Well, I mean, not entirely. I mean, I think that the traditional arguments in this field is that there are different levels of theory of mind competencies, starting with Dan Dennett's intentional stance, which is a very, for all intents and purposes, a very basic, low-level type of theory of mind, where you see things happening for a reason. There are intentions or goals associated with movement in the environment, but it's not a fully fledged, sophisticated theory of mind of trying to understand somebody's beliefs and desires and what they're thinking. It's more just sort of a sensitivity to agency.
Let's talk about that, because you wrote in your book that people with clinically impaired theory of mind abilities, one would assume that they'd be less susceptible to that kind of thinking.
Right. So there's some ongoing research suggesting that individuals with, one of my former PhD students, Bethany Haywood, had done some work on this, which was indicative, at least, or sort of moving in this direction, that people who have theory of mind impairments, namely people with autism or the autistic spectrum, and principally people with Asperger syndrome, who are very high functioning but have social cognitive impairments, have a very different conceptualization of God, in particular, as being much less interested in their individual lives and trying to communicate with them and having a certain sort of interpersonal relationship and giving them messages. And God is much more sort of a cosmological, physical prime mover sort of interacts with particles in the environment. It's much more sort of engineering type God than it is a psychological God.
Which is fascinating. So autistic people still have a religion. So
right, and you oftentimes find autistic people that are very religious, and that could be explained by their predisposition to be attracted to highly organized, right, routinized, ritualistic types of activities. And many organized religious systems obviously give them a great infrastructure for that.
And in completely the opposite direction, schizophrenics have an entirely different relationship with God.
Right, so schizophrenics, I mean, some people have thought that schizophrenics are sort of on the opposite end of that spectrum, where they see meaning and signs from God or some other hidden abstract entity trying to give them messages everywhere. Everything is about them. Everything is about their behavior. God is sort of lurking in the shadows around, you know, every corner. Schizophrenia and schizophrenic hallucinations are oftentimes characterized by a very explicit religious type of symbolism.
You actually studied superstition under controlled conditions. So maybe tell us about Princess Alice, because that is fascinating.
Well, we've done a number of studies using Princess Alice, and Princess Alice is basically, we've used Princess Alice for studies that we do with children when we try to determine basically how they respond when they think that they're in the room with an invisible person. Does telling them that they're in the room with somebody that they can't see, sort of a proxy of a supernatural agent like God or your dead mother or something like that, does that somehow meaningfully change their behavior? And the most recent study that we've published with, again, two of my former PhD students, Jared Piazza and Gordon Ingram, we had three groups of children, actually, and they were all playing the same game. And the game was very, it was rigged and it was very difficult, but we were trying to sort of slightly encourage them to cheat. So it was one of those dartboard games where you throw a ball against a Velcro dartboard. You know, the ball sticks on the dartboard, so that part's easy enough. But there were three rules that they had to follow, very, very strictly follow. They couldn't cross a certain line that was marked by masking tape on the floor. That was quite a distance away from the actual board. They had to stand with their back facing the dartboard, and they had to throw with their non-dominant hand. So we made it an impossible task. But we also told them that whoever got the highest score on this game would get something really special, sort of an amazing prize that they could take home with them. So we really sort of amped up their motive to cheat without explicitly telling them to cheat. Those were the rules of the game. That was the rule of the game, and all children across all three conditions that I'll tell you about in just a moment got those basic instructions. The control group was just the control group. That's all they heard. The second group was a group that got those instructions, but there was an actual human experimenter sitting in the chair with them. Sitting in a chair in front of them while they were alone, while they were in the room playing this game. He was watching them the whole time. So there was an actual physical person sitting in a chair right before them. And in the third group of children, I suppose, were the most interesting. They were given the rules of the game, but they were told that there was an invisible woman sitting in that chair named Princess Alice. And she was friendly and everything, but she was there. The experimenter said, I've got to do something. You play the game. I'm going to leave you here alone in the room. And meanwhile, we've got hidden cameras all over the place in the room to find out how they behave when they think that they are alone, at least the first and the third conditions, to see if they cheat, basically. And, to cut to the chase, the kids who were in the control condition, who didn't hear anything about the invisible woman, who weren't left in the room with an actual person sitting in a chair, they did things like, you know, they were just sort of egregiously cheating by walking right up to the board and putting the ball right in the bullseye, and then going back and you know, pretending that they got it. And we have all this on tape, of course, and then we show them afterward, and and most of them, of course, denied cheating.
Of course.
Which I think I would have done too when I was seven. The most significant thing was that those kids who heard about Princess Alice, this invisible woman, were significantly less likely to cheat. They basically behaved on the task the same way that the children who were in the room with an actual person behaved. So merely giving them the impression that there's some watcher evaluating their social behaviors, especially these highly tempting opportunities, meaningfully changes social behavior. So superstition can, and it sort of, you know, that ties into a bigger sort of evolutionary portrait that I've tried to sort of sketch out in the book, which is that they, by having this, by suffering the illusion that we are being watched, especially under conditions when we think we could, we might be able to get away with something, but in fact we're underestimating the risk of actual social detection by other people, thinking that you are being evaluated and potentially you will be punished later on in some meaningful way, will change your behavior to make you less likely to cheat. So it's going to save your reputation.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm here with Jesse Baring. He's the author of The Belief Instinct. And here's a question from Kat.
What do Jesse and Des think about the possibility of a faith gene or a biological reason for believing?
Well, you start, Des.
I just ask the questions.
Yes. I mean, I'm not a behavioral geneticist, so I don't typically sort of focus in on that level. But of course, everything is going to boil down to some sort of genetic structure, sort of the mechanics and the neurological apparatus that motivates these cognitions. There is some interesting work that I'm aware of showing that religiosity is heritable, but it's important to understand what exactly that means. Religiosity is basically the extent to which you are emotionally invested in the topic of religion. So this evidence suggests that you might have a pair of identical twins, and one of those twins is a, you know, evangelical Christian, very strong feelings, and the other is a screaming atheist. They're both like really passionate about the topic of God and religion, but the content of their beliefs differ.
Interesting.
And, you know, of course, they've done all the adoption studies and reared apart, reared together, and fraternal versus identical twins and all that stuff. And religiosity is seems to be to have a fairly meaningful concordance rate, which means that in terms of matching identical twins.
So from reading your book and hearing you now, do you think that belief in God played a positive evolutionary role then?
I think that the illusion that there is such a thing as consequences for our social behaviors that go beyond mere human punishment had dramatic effects over the course of human evolution that worked in the sense of making us a successful species. I don't know if I would go so far as saying that it's a good thing, or it was a good thing or a bad thing or anything along those lines. It simply is just the way it works. It's the way that our brains work. But I think the question is a very different one today when we look at whether belief in God, for example, is a good thing or a bad thing. First of all, I'm not so naive as to believe that somehow we can eradicate these intuitive cognitive systems and somehow exercise ourselves of the ghost of God or a belief in the afterlife or anything along those lines, because the atheistic belief system goes against the grain of our natural human psychology. It's not impossible to be atheistic. Obviously, there are lots of people who are, but it's cognitively effortful. And so I suppose I'm very pessimistic in the sense of it ever being meaningfully eradicated, even if it were a good thing to be rid of superstition or religion or God or whatever. But I also think that there are obvious salubrious benefits of believing when you're ill, for instance. You know, loads of studies suggesting that the power of belief is very dramatic and potentially significant. And I don't think it's a good thing necessarily for those individuals to lose their faith.
Well, you wrote that the idea of a punitive God did mm-hmm. help evolutionarily when we underestimated the risk of being caught doing things that we shouldn't be doing.
Right. So part of that idea is that one of the things, in addition to theory of mind, one of the other things that makes us different from other species is the fact that we have language. And language has always been conceptualized from an evolutionary perspective as a very good thing, because it allowed us to share our intersubjective experiences and to communicate information across generations and to build cultural traditions. And all of these things are very good, don't get me wrong. But there was also a dark side to the evolution of language. Because not only were we just simply talking about the good things, but we were also gathering bits of information about others through gossip and learning about the things that other people did wrong, which helped us to make adaptive decisions with them. So if I heard that some person was abusing a child or was a notorious thief or something like that, my behavior toward that person would subsequently change. So it's adaptive information to have. The flip side of that is that all of a sudden now people were scrutinizing our social behaviors, and as soon as we slipped up and did something bad, that information could be gossiped as well and can basically spread from mind to mind to mind to mind, and ultimately it's going to come back to hurt us. So we had to be very careful about inhibiting what would have been prepotent, impulsive decision-making prior to the evolution of language. So God comes into the mix here when we think, again, that there isn't anybody watching us. There aren't any other people watching us, so we don't have to worry about this risk of gossip. But in fact, we're underestimating it. They really are around. But if we think that God is watching us, then we're afraid of or gods or our dead relatives punishing us, then that's going to prevent us from doing something that ultimately would lead to our exposure. And it just takes one big slip up to really have a disastrous reputational effect. And especially when we're talking about the concept, in the ancestral past, when you might have had just 30 to 50 individuals living in your society, where social information was absolutely vital.
So what makes one person an atheist and then another one religious then, if this psychological capacity is in everybody?
It's a very important question, and it's one that we don't have the answer to. I mean, I think that nobody knows developmentally what leads one child to grow up to be an atheist and another to be a believer. So that's not clear. I can't answer that question. There are individual differences in terms of analytical styles and those types of things, but nobody knows at this point what makes an atheist go in that direction. It's certainly the very slim minority of people that actually become atheists, unless you've got sort of a natural leg up and are on the autistic scale. It's not something that typically emerges with ease, and it's definitely a very small sliver of the human demographic. And we don't know the developmental trajectory that leads there.
Well, see, the theory of mind makes sense to me. In fact, this all makes sense to me. But are these things pretty much unprovable by chance?
Well, there's some rhetorical value, I think. And I think that, I'd be the first person to acknowledge that. But it's also based on and grounded in, decades of empirical research that leads you to, if not a fail-safe conclusion, a fairly convincing, commonsensical conclusion about these ideas.
Jesse, this is fascinating work and really, really good to have you on the show.
Thank you. I appreciate having the opportunity.
You can find links to Jesse Baring, author of The Belief Instinct, on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And I do suggest that you take a look at his site, because Jesse has another book coming out soon called Why Is the Penis Shaped Like That? And I felt like that deserved a mention, really.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. Thank you.
But first, do go to our site. That's skepticallyspeaking.com, and you'll find links to Twitter, Facebook, and Google+, and also to iTunes, where you can listen to past episodes or subscribe to the show. Before we go, we wanted to ask for your help with a new project. Listener Linda Brunette is a writer looking to put some science into her fiction about skeptics and the paranormal. She wrote to us asking for suggestions for supernatural topics that her skeptical characters can investigate. And since we at Skeptically Speaking love a bit of crowdsourcing, we thought we'd ask you to help us brainstorm. If you've got a favorite supernatural or paranormal topic that you'd like to see tackled in factually based fiction, go to our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can leave a suggestion in the comments for this episode, which is show number 162, The Science of Belief. And we can't wait to see what you'll come up with. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. 'Cause we're skeptically speaking.